It's an abuse of power. It's an obstruction of justice. And that is a basis for not permitting the pardon.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. And on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, my conversation with Tom Sullivan, the former president of the University of Vermont. He's now professor emeritus of political science, focusing on constitutional law, American legal history, and impeachment. We spoke Monday afternoon.
Well, it's historic, to be sure. We have never had a president impeached twice. We've had three presidents impeached by the House once. So if this goes forward, it'll be the first time in history that a single same president is sought to be impeached twice.
What did you think of what you saw at the Capitol on January 6th?
Well, as a lawyer and a former federal prosecutor, I first thought of the United States Code, the federal code, with regard to what offenses may be in front of us, as we saw it visually on the screen. And there are a number of offenses, and without getting into the deep detail of the criminal law, certainly incitement to violence is probably the principal one, and I would assume that would be probably Article 1 if there were an article of impeachment coming forth this week.
A lot of people have been using the term, you know, insurrection, a mob. Are those the right terms in your point of view?
Well, I think they're commonly used and known terms. In the law, it would probably be something like incitement to violence, mob activity, you know, conjures up other images for us. But I think those pictures and the visualization that we saw throughout the last several days clearly bring forth for anyone watching that this was a group of people who went well beyond the First Amendment speech rights and engaged in criminal activity. And there presumably are numerous criminal violations, which we hear that many of the rioters are now being charged with. So multiple criminal violations were we could see literally watching the TV.
What about the people who spoke at the rally before that mob went to the Capitol? Can President Trump or his family members or his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, make their own claim to a First Amendment protection here?
They presumably will make that claim, but this clearly goes over the line in my view. One has the First Amendment right of speech to discuss, but when you begin to advocate and use words that clearly demonstrate that you're advocating violence and the breaking of law, that crosses the line, well crosses the line from First Amendment rights into criminal violations. And it's clear from all of our history that the First Amendment is not a defense to a criminal violation.
So if I'm hearing you right, this is the proverbial don't yell fire in a crowded theater situation played out on a massive scale.
That's right. That happens to be one exception to the First Amendment, the so-called clear and present danger, or later termed fighting words, or more recently, a true threat. But I'm mentioning another exception to the First Amendment, which is if you engage in criminal conduct, there is no speech defense or protection. And if you're advocating that kind of conduct, then you cross the First Amendment line for no protection under the First Amendment.
President Trump, he has his own lawyers, and they're good. If he looks around at what happened last week and says, boy, I've got to pardon myself before I go, could that protect him from what you've been talking about here?
Well, with regard to the pardon power, when you look at the Constitution of the United States, it looks as though the president has almost exclusive pardon power. But when you look at the constitutional history behind that, because we've never had an example of a president pardoning himself. It turns out in Watergate, President Nixon, who was a lawyer himself, considered pardoning himself and decided that under the Constitution, he could not do that. So that's one example. But my own view of looking at the pardon clause is that a president cannot pardon himself or herself because the founders, when they were debating this in 1787, were very, very clear that they wanted to make sure that the president was not above the law. This is where we hear the term rule of law in our country, which basically means no one, regardless of stature or position, is above or is accepted from the law. So my own view reading the Constitution and looking at constitutional history is that a president cannot pardon himself or herself because that would put them above the law and not subject to prosecution or any other legal constraint. And clearly that is contrary to all the framers and founders of the Constitution phrasing. I think they cannot do that. And particularly, I think, if the president is engaged in conduct that, in fact, is an abuse of power or an obstruction of justice, then I believe they do not have the right to engage in that pardon.
What would be the test for it?
Well, the test would be background and context. Why might President X be giving someone a pardon? Is that someone potentially a witness against him? And he's giving him a pardon to silence the person? That would clearly be an obstruction of justice, a federal offense, a felony, actually, under the federal code. And I don't think our founders ever considered a president having the right to pardon when the purpose and the context of that pardon is to silence a particular witness against him. In other words, it's an abuse of power, it's an obstruction of justice, and that is a basis for not permitting the pardon.
Let's turn back to impeachment, if we can. I know you've taught on this subject. President Trump was impeached over the, quote, perfect phone call with Ukraine. If the House takes up a second impeachment effort, which looks very likely as we speak, with 1 week to go before the president's term is up, what could be gained by that? What would be the point of doing that at this late stage?
Well, a number of reasons would be, and we can talk about the practicalness of that happening in the next 10 days or not, but the purpose of why the Congress may want to take that up is because they believe that the president has engaged in conduct which is impeachable, and that it is not tolerable to have him remain in office, in this case, a very short time, of course. Second, you want, and the founders were very clear about this when they were debating the impeachment clause right next to the Article 2, which gives the president so much other power. The founders were clear that they wanted to make sure that if the president is engaged in such egregious conduct that is impeachable, that there should be an opportunity to remove him immediately, even before an election, because the election, of course, is another way to have a president be removed from office. So they wanted to make sure that if a president engages in such conduct, that there is a mechanism under the Constitution, Article 2, to be able to remove him quickly, not even waiting for the next election, because it's such an egregious offensive abuse of conduct that he's engaged in. That's the constitutional history behind it. Third, I would say, is deterrence. And this goes back to the point about the founders demanding accountability of presidential leadership, and that is deterrence. If you don't account for the conduct with some measure, whether it be the 25th Amendment or a censor or impeachment, some conduct against the president, then you won't deter future presidents from engaging in such conduct. So there's a very strong deterrent element as well, and accountability element.
I have a question about the timeline. When President Trump was impeached the first time, we aired the hearings from gavel to gavel just about on WAMC. And part of it was that it was even though it was a political move, an impeachment, not a criminal trial, was that it was treated very deliberately in terms of taking testimony, hours of testimony, experts, multiple cross-examinations, and so on. And we started with, you know, the House Judiciary Committee and then went through the Senate. At the end of it, anyone who wanted to know what was at issue in the impeachment had a fair chance to hear all of that testimony. If this was being done, and we're hearing talk now that perhaps the Senate wouldn't even take it up until January 19th at the earliest, one day left in the term, would we lose something by having such an expedited second impeachment?
Well, again, it depends upon the context and the nature. And by that, I mean, how clear and how direct is the evidence versus how circumstantial or ambiguous is the evidence. The first impeachment of President Trump was a complicated case with lots of evidence and lots of witnesses that needed to be presented. In this matter, it's all out there on the TV screen to be able to see at least whether incitement to riot and encouraging rioting disruption at the Capitol. That's direct evidence. The president's own speeches given for some time, not just the day before or the day of, but for some time, show a pattern of conduct and behavior from which you can infer the intent. So all of this is a more streamlined, focused, single issue, or perhaps two issues here, very different from the first impeachment, which was long and complicated, where witnesses needed to be heard to be able to weave the story to reach the conclusion that the House managers were trying to assert.
Just one more thing. You said at the beginning, you know, an impeachment is exceedingly rare in American history. But now we've got the chance to have a third presidential impeachment within really the last two decades, more or less. Are you worried that, you know, they're setting a precedent in Congress to have every president face an impeachment from the opposition party going forward because, you know, people in Washington like to get even sometimes?
Well, it is to be sure, as you said, that we're using it a bit more regularly. We've only had four near attempts that I'm including here, President Nixon, who surely would have been impeached and probably surely convicted had he not resigned on the eve of. So we really have history of not only the three actual impeachments, but President Nixon's, which was an example right up until the end. So in our long 232-year history, I guess four examples is not a lot, but it is an extraordinary remedy under the Constitution, which the founders did not expect to be used that often, unless you really needed to remove a president because of abuse of power. I guess I'm not worried. I would hope that our leaders, and of course, the impeachment clause applies to civil servants as well as and judges as well as the president, although we typically only talk about presidential impeachments. But we've had a lot of impeachments with judges and civil servants over the course of our years. We just don't, through the media, listen as much or hear as much about those. I'm not worried. I'm not worried that we will be using it too often. I think House and Senate members are leery of that, and that would be its own kind of check in the system.
Is there anything I didn't ask you about that you'd like to mention?
Well, one of the questions that is now coming up, and there is an ambiguousness in the law, is what if on Wednesday articles of impeachment in the House are brought and within 10 days, President Trump is out of office and the Senate is not able to process the transmittal from the House. Can an impeachment go on after he is removed? The Constitution does not speak directly to that. It's not explicit, the answer. Clearly, the framers were talking about initially when you are in office to be removed from office, which is a circumstance we have right now, assuming there's time. But if the, quote, clock were to run out here and he is out of office, the Constitution is not explicit about that. Constitutional history might suggest that as long as the impeachment process has started and it is not yet fully complete before he leaves office, then it can continue after he's out of office. There's nothing directly in the Constitution about that. One can argue it both ways, but I think the practice, we've had some practice where in several instances where there's been an impeachment and the person has been out of office and nevertheless the House and Senate agreed to convict. This is obviously not in the case of a president, but in lower federal officials.
Now, that's interesting because let's say the trial goes on after Trump is out of office and the Senate, because Democrats basically want to make sure that President Trump can't run again in 2024. And that's part of the inspiration for this process. But the Senate will be in the Democrats' control plus one with the tie-breaking vote by Kamala Harris. But to convict, it would still require two-thirds vote, right?
Yes, that is right. And I think your point is well taken, that right now it seems to be that one of the driving factors for the timing of this is not just to get a conviction on the impeachment coming over from the House, assuming that be the case, but also under the Constitution, the Senate has the discretion, separate from the vote on conviction on the impeachment charge, assuming impeached, should they also bar him from ever being a candidate for public office again. That's a separate discretion for the Senate under the Constitution. And as you suggest, there appears to be a lot of sentiment here that impeachment alone is not enough. We want to, or this is the argument, to bar him from ever being a candidate for public office again. So it's that second discretionary clause that I think is what everybody's looking at right now. And the interesting thing there is, well, you note that it takes two-thirds for a conviction in the Senate, which is a very, very high bar. No president has ever been convicted, largely history records, because of that two-thirds requirement. But if he were convicted, constitutional history suggests that a majority vote alone would be enough in the Senate to bar him from public office again. And that's one of the goals I think is probably being looked at by the House managers.
That's interesting. So that could be a 51-50 decision, and then President Trump is out. He can't run again in 2024. That's all it would take.
I believe that's true. The Constitution does not explicitly tell us what that vote margin needs to be, but we have had cases, lower federal officers, where it has been triggered and it only took a majority. So I think perhaps it's a settled expectation now that if the Senate were to convict, they would also clearly have the discretion to bar him from public office again, and history would record that that would only take a majority vote, not two-thirds.
That's former UVM President Tom Sullivan. Thank you for taking all this time. I hope we can call you back as this develops at some point. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. That does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.